And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we are really, really pleased to have with us once again Dr. Art Sear. He has been the monthly visitor to the morning show, I think pretty much without interruption, for well over two decades. And his presence on the morning show is always welcome as he offers his thoughtful commentary and analysis on various current issues and events and concerns both here and abroad. He writes a column that is seen in newspapers all across the country, is also author of After the Cold War. And we're going to be talking about several of his most recent columns and some of what they explore and discuss. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be here, Greg, partly because you're such a serious and informed and gracious host. I wish everybody liked me as much as you do.
Well, I do try to be gracious, and it's easy to be gracious to you, and I'm really glad that that you are joining us. I have to say that your most recent column, which I'm not even sure if it has seen print yet or
no.
If it has just...
We're hearing about it first.
All right.
It was this week's column. I'll be sending it out today.
Yes, I appreciate that. And it explores some things that are quite confusing to me, and so I appreciated the clarity that I came away with after reading it. At least your headline, I don't know if it will always be the headline where it appears in newspapers, called The Financial Markets and Reality. And yeah. Just trying to spell out some basics. And of course, part of what you're touching on is that this current presidential race, as far as many voters are concerned, really hinges on our country's economic well-being. And where are we now versus where we were 4 years ago, and who gets the credit, who gets the blame, and so on. But, you know, you're really touching on what a lot of us kind of look at with a fair amount of misunderstanding. And I appreciate the clarity with which you write about this. And one of the things you do is try to spell out the good news, but within a truthful context, that not everything about our economy right now is reason to celebrate. And yet there are some very, very fundamental, important signs of strength and growth. So first of all, maybe you could, is the presidential race and talk about the economy, is that what mostly prompted you to write this column at this point in time?
No, actually separate from the presidential race and institutionally insulated is the Federal Reserve Board. And their committee just met, and they decided to lower interest rates by a full one-half of 1%, which is a lot in Fed terms and Fed speak. And clearly they, after vast analysis of vast amounts of data by serious professionals, the Federal Reserve is confident that inflation, which is a little over 2%, is approaching 2%. So they're comfortable in shifting gears and putting emphasis on trying to keep unemployment down.
Can you just explain for the layperson what the connection there is? I mean, the way in which interest rates, the reason that has such a direct and significant effect on something like, for instance, unemployment and other things?
Significant, but not that direct. There's always a drag unless something really strange is going on. But it means that it's cheaper to borrow money, noticeably cheaper. Interest rates historically have been quite low for most of this century. We really are living in a very fortunate time in that sense. But it makes money easier to borrow, so it'll be easier for business entrepreneurs and corporations and would-be home buyers and college students and their beleaguered parents to borrow money to pay for the new house, the new car, the new investment, the new gamble. And when you raise interest rates, that does have a breaking effect on, tend to have a breaking effect on the economy. I hope that's clear. The most important fact, and one that bears on both the Fed and the political race, where economic matters are important but not really much seriously discussed any time, actually, but certainly in recent times, is that since 1940, the first year of World War II in Europe, and the year before we entered, thanks to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, every two decades, more or less, at least in nominal terms, our gross domestic product has doubled, which is phenomenal, absolutely extraordinary. We're at about $20 trillion, and I look at it from time to time, and sure enough, if things stay on track, we'll be up to $40 trillion. So that's why the mess in Washington doesn't have to end. That's why deficits can continue as they have, with only a couple of exceptions. Bill Clinton is one, Dwight Eisenhower is another. They're able to actually balance the budget. The degree to which federal spending, especially at the government level, can go on and on, mostly in the red, is because people want to invest in the U.S., and also we have a phenomenally productive economy. That's the most important fact.
Yeah, I think you say that as one of three fundamental points that you want all Americans to remember. The U.S. has the most productive economy in the world, and you do cite that,
especially
that
over
statistic.
The long term.
Right, and you cite that statistic of our GNP doubling, essentially, every two decades since 1940, which is I think especially in this interconnected world in which we live, I think a lot of us just sort of blithely assume that that's kind of the way it's been for all economies, I mean, at least the successful economies around the world. But what you're suggesting is that that level of sustained growth is essentially unprecedented and unparalleled in the world.
Yeah, quite extraordinary. And it means the average person in America does quite well. Not easy to live here. We're a very turbulent, unstable society, and in certain ways always have been. But among countries in the world, we face distinctive challenges concerning the family and other traditional institutions. And it's tough to be a young person, and it's tough to be an old person, and it's challenging in between. We're a very individualistic country, and we are plagued, among other things, with these terrible, not frequent, but pretty regular now, mass killings by demented males, only occasionally females. These are really serious problems. But wealth we've got, just an extraordinary economy, partly because of the diversity of our population and partly because of the gigantic natural resources that we have in North America.
And although
accessible north natural resources,
sure,
in contrast to Siberia and a lot of South America.
I think the concern that some might raise is the fact that although we do have a tremendous amount of wealth, we do see a widening gap in terms of folks at the very, 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 very top, you know, versus the bottom. But I have heard you argue before, and I think you are persuasive in saying that even for those that find themselves struggling in this economy, I mean, who are not sharing fully the fruits of this wealth you're talking about, that for the vast majority of citizens, life is so much better than it once was, and
yes,
that we need to keep this in perspective.
And we live very comfortably. The average person in this country is quite rich compared to the average American or the average person anywhere else 100 years ago and even less. The current period, because of the concentration of wealth among those at the very top, is often compared to the Gilded Age in the 1890s to the 1920s. And statistically, there's a lot of truth to that. But the average worker was really struggling. Daily life was a struggle for survival, and you didn't have a credit card, and you didn't have disposable income. the way we do today. Like I've been trying to underscore, life is tough in distinctive ways in this country, psychologically, socially. But the wealth is great. And since 1970, the disparity has been growing. But the last couple of years, last few years, there's indications that it's decreasing thanks to the tight labor market. We've had a very tight labor market, but inflation has remained fairly low, especially given the gigantic, the so-called infrastructure bill, which Republicans and conservatives refer to as the inflation bill of the Biden administration. We can just absorb tremendous amounts of economic dislocation.
I want to ask you about one of your other fundamental points that you talked about at the very end of the column, right after you reminded all of us about the essential robustness of our economy.
Yeah.
You then say, as citizens, we need to be active. Serious, sustained public oversight of financial activity is essential. I'm curious what you're getting at that in terms of what a typical, ordinary citizen would do. I mean, what would be the means by which an ordinary citizen could, in a sense, participate in oversight of what's going on in our country?
Well, pay attention to our government. Politicians do respond. I don't want to turn this into a high school civics class. But if you do communicate, they will respond in most cases, including at the federal level, certainly at the county and local level. We do have very effective, more effective regulation than ever before of the financial services industry. And I think overall Congress and the Bush and then Bush II and then Obama administrations did an effective job, including in hindsight, of responding to that very, very serious financial crash, tremendous strains on the liquidity of our economy. And it started in the subprime mortgage market in the housing industry, a deregulated industry largely that turned into casino gambling. It was Las Vegas in the banker's clothes. And it reverberated globally to a great financial challenge. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation performed extremely well. The Securities and Exchange Commission performed extremely well, for which Republicans and conservatives can thank Franklin D. Roosevelt and Joseph P. Kennedy, the first head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, who was so smart and who knew the game so well that the regulations he and his very, very talented staff put in place in the mid-1930s haven't been changed all that much. And Sarbanes-Oxley, the new banking regulations that resulted from that, thanks to Paul Volcker, a truly dedicated public servant who came back yet again, even though he was pretty old, when President Obama asked him to really help sort out the banking mess. So our government institutions do work, and we work much better than a command economy or the old-time dictatorships, which fortunately have faded.
Right. I also appreciate the long historical view that you take in this column. I mean, you spend plenty of time talking about the present, but plenty of time talking about the past
you.
As well, including, of course, the Great Depression and what that disaster represented at that time. And one of the things I just wanted to mention is something I hadn't really stopped to think about. You said that, you know, in a sense, one of the most lasting legacies of the Great Depression was public suspicion as well as outright hostility towards bankers. And you say that defined American political life for decades. I hadn't stopped to think about that as a long-term ramification of the Great Depression, the way in which the average person viewed banks and bankers and that whole sector of our economy.
There are very significant, obviously very, very talented executives who in the post-war era built international banking. The well-known for many years pervasive David Rockefeller from the famous famous bank at Chase, what was Chase Manhattan Bank, I think. Walter Ruston at Citicorp, which is now Citi. Got lots of big problems. And Bank of America, where Tom Clawson, like these other gentlemen, built international banking. I was trying to learn more about Tom Clawson at one point, and that was not easy to do. I finally decided he liked being kind of a mystery man. Ruston was much more forthcoming, and his memoirs are very readable. He's from a very distinguished family of diplomats. There are centers, buildings, institutes at Brown University named for the Ruston family, and they personify the old-time Eastern establishment, which used to run finance and foreign policy until Vietnam. Very blunt, candid memoirs. He was a good friend of Clawson, so I decided to try to learn more about him. He got out of the Navy, which is traditionally the upper-class branch. He'd been a Navy officer in World War II. And he wrote in the service during the war and for some time afterwards, I didn't mention that I was a banker. I didn't mention that I was a banker. I mean, it was really bad. The last time we had that kind of politicians getting that kind of mileage out of anti-business sentiment was probably during the Kennedy administration. But we were in a truly revolutionary time in the 30s and 40s.
Incredible.
It is incredible to us, but it's important, therefore, to understand what that was like. So
absolutely.
One time since our Civil War that we've been on the verge of a real revolution, I believe, in the 1930s.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Dr. Art Sear. He is paying his monthly visit to the program, and we are talking through some of his most recent columns and the matters that that they touch upon. I want to talk just a little bit about something that you mentioned in one of your recent columns, something which received scant attention from the media, namely the most recent visit of Britain's relatively new prime minister visit with President O'Biden. And it gave you an opportunity to talk about the exceptionally strong and warm relationship between the United States and Great Britain, a almost unique partnership that continues so vibrantly.
Yes, indeed. It really is a special relationship. Which I think I think Winston Churchill coined that term. I do know McGeorge Bundy, President Kennedy's national security advisor, liked to say there's someone to talk to. I know that because I heard him say that when I was working for him at the Ford Foundation.
So he was saying Britain is that kind of partner for us.
I mean,
someone with whom we can relate and talk about and share our problems, share our hopes and dreams.
It hasn't always been that way, of course, and indeed, as recently as the 1920s, Big Bill Thompson, the last Republican mayor of Chicago, not to be confused with Big Jim Thompson, the multi-term governor of Illinois, one of the smartest people I've ever been around. He would have been a great Supreme Court justice, which I think was his real aspiration. Anyway, the other big guy regularly, especially when it was a campaign year, would say that if the King of England ever shows up in Chicago, I'm going to punch him in the nose and run him out of town. Mind you, there was never any indication that at that point the King of England or anybody else from the royal family wanted to come to Chicago. They probably had at some point, but our Irish population, as you know and our listeners know, was quite large at the time. President Kennedy, speaking of Bundy, particularly relied on that relationship because he had lousy relations with Konrad Adenauer in Germany and Charles de Gaulle in France. Harold Macmillan in Britain had a kind of avuncular, almost mentoring relationship with a much younger, relatively inexperienced American president, and he really, really helped a lot. And even though the British, in hindsight, wisely declined great pressure from the Johnson administration to join us in our war in Vietnam. A lot of Australians did. They sent about 60,000 troops to Vietnam, and they're extraordinarily effective at jungle warfare, and they really are great guys, as we were discussing off the air, and they really like Americans. So it's not just Britain, but the whole Commonwealth is, I believe, an underestimated network of support for us.
And you say at the end of your column that, you know, not only do we enjoy this close connection, but you say together, we, meaning the U.S. and Britain, provide an international anchor.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Well, together we represent a good deal of military ability. The British fleet is at least the second largest in the world in terms of total number of ships. Now, they're not a lot of big capital ships, but they are very effective, as are British soldiers, hence my reference to the Australians. The two countries have a very, very similar worldview. And I was able to get an article published a couple of years ago in Parameters, the U.S. Army War College journal, developing the theme that with Brexit, in many ways, is a bad idea, and the British will pay a high price economically. That was just a fact of life. You didn't have to be very insightful. But it's an opportunity for us to renew and tighten our military and intelligence cooperation. There's something called the Five Eyes, which is not much publicized. It's the U.S., Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, the five countries' intelligence agencies, civilian intelligence agencies, especially regularly share information and compare notes and other things with Britain out of the EU, at least for now. I hope they are able to return. It actually loosens, frees things up. You don't have to worry about the Eurocrats in Brussels to share really sensitive information.
I hope
that's clear.
Yeah, very much so. Talking about that actually is going to divert me out of the order I was going to take. I think I want to go from here to a column you wrote recently in which you talk about something that happened, we're coming up on 3 years ago, namely the disaster in Afghanistan involving our withdrawal from Afghanistan and the really tragically unfortunate way in which that occurred. In particular, you point out, and I should preface this by saying you write this because you think there are valuable lessons that hopefully we've learned already to some extent, and one hopes will continue to learn from this debacle, including the fact that this withdrawal from Afghanistan unfolded, in your words, contrary to customary procedures as well as contrary to common sense.
Yeah, the military left first. It turned into total chaos and disaster. 13 American military people were killed in a suicide bombing, and untold Afghans. I got a telephone call. It was really quite disturbing and personally kind of heartrending. One of my former students on international political economy at Carthage College, she's making her way as a banker in Milwaukee, and she's from Afghanistan, like a lot of people from other countries who come to this part of the country to go to school. They had family ties in Milwaukee, and she was anxious to try to get in touch with them. And unbelievably, I was able to very directly reach another more recent graduate, very impressive young Marine Corps officer who was a finance major but was my advisee. And he was able to make some inquiries that helped put her in contact with her relatives. Unfortunately, she just called as everything was collapsing in Afghanistan. It's a good lesson to me in modern telecommunications how phenomenal it is.
Right.
To be able to get in touch with anybody in the world in maybe 30 minutes,
yeah.
Even in the midst of chaos and violence.
Right.
But it brought home to me just how chaotic and disorganized was this operation, run directly from the White House by President Joe Biden and his immediate staff.
And, of course, one of the reasons that this occurred was a failure of intelligence, and in particular I mean, a gross misunderstanding, misassessment of the state of affairs with the Afghanistan government and military, and the way we withdrew was on the assumption that they were more stable than, of course, they turned out to be.
There's a more fundamental point, if I may disagree, that is the military left first.
Well, right.
A political decision by the White House, they leave last. Everybody else got the hell out of there. No, it was the worst kind of Washington decision-making by careerist politicians, young and including the guy in the White House.
Sure.
Where the buck stops.
Right.
Oh, sorry to get carried away, it was just awful.
Right.
And in very personal terms, it got brought home to me how awful it was.
Right. And I think it's one of the few things that a whole lot of Americans have agreed about. And I mean, on both sides of the aisle was, you know, terrible... terrible sadness and regret about what happened and how it happened and so on. I wanted to go to this column because one of the points you bring home in terms of lessons to learn from that disaster is the importance of not only shoring up our means of gathering and analyzing intelligence, but also the importance of being cooperative in terms of intelligence being shared. That is part of the whole point of it, and that seems to be something that had not happened in this particular instance.
Yeah, there's lots of lessons, and you have the right attitude. See what you can learn from what happened in the past. Our great American failing, which the British in no way share, is that we think anybody can be an American, and constitutionally that's true, and Ronald Reagan, I think, at the Berlin Wall, said that. Certainly in New York, at the Statue of Liberty, he said that. It's true, but we go into other countries thinking that the people there want to be Americans.
And that we should be in the business of transforming other countries.
A lot of these people want to be Americans, Lieutenant, in Vietnam. Trouble is, a lot of them just don't realize that yet. Part of our job is to make sure these people realize just how great it is to be like Americans. That's what they really want. And this was not a stupid man, but it's a characteristic American approach to the world.
Right.
That on a regular basis has led to serious problems for us.
And one of the things you suggest is that we went into Afghanistan with this idea of transforming this ancient nation, organized in so many ways fundamentally different from the way our country is organized, and went in there with this idea that we could reshape Afghanistan into a country of our liking, and that just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, and there the British can be very helpful because no English person especially thinks anybody else can actually be English. And all kidding aside, they emphasize human intelligence. We love technology. We love electronics. And we're extraordinarily good at it. But starting with the Clinton administration and the end of the Cold War, we started de-emphasizing human intelligence, which is labor-intensive. It's very costly. You have to deal with very unpleasant, sometimes literally insane people. But you can't rely on electronics alone. And I'm sorry to say that especially over the last 30 years or so, that's what the U.S. government has been doing from everything I hear.
Right. So there is real importance that we maybe reexamine the way we gather and analyze intelligence. And I really loved this line when you say the international effort to transform Afghanistan was misguided. In the future, patient realism, calculated diplomacy, and selective aid should guide policy, not failed utopianism.
Yeah, the British had three failed military missions and lost one entire army in Afghanistan in the 1830s. One man in desperate conditions was seen to be staggering toward the supply ship on the coast, finally, in South Asia. And they thought he was a messenger. He was a survivor. He was a medical doctor that the Afghan warriors had allowed to live so he could tell the British, this is what we do to you. Don't come back. Eventually, they were able to, through bribery, human intelligence, and very, very shrewd diplomacy, the British were able to establish good relations with Kabul. They never were dumb enough to try to go out into the countryside, into the bush. And they finally withdrew in 1919. But they maintained influence there. And I believe that was one factor, among others, that kept Afghanistan neutral in World War II and helped prevent the Wehrmacht and the Imperial Japanese Army from linking up in India when we were losing the war.
Right. Let's turn our attention to Israel and Gaza and a recent column that you wrote in which you talk about CIA Director William Burns and his British counterpart, M16 Chief Richard Moore, and their efforts to secure a peace agreement in Gaza between Israel and Hamas. Explain how it is that the director of the CIA would be involved in something like this, and how customary is that?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's customary. I think that's good that we don't know.
Ah.
We actually shouldn't know. We have a particularly important and sensitive relationship with Mossad and other intelligence arms of the government of Israel. And the fact that the British and the Americans are working together to press the regime, I think my guess is the Biden administration is trying to use this particularly sensitive nerve ending to try to get Netanyahu's attention and get him to look beyond something besides war and his own personal political survival. The two are intermixed.
Right.
Once this war ends, Netanyahu is in some serious legal difficulty, as is his wife. In that sense, I think it's very shrewd. The MI6 is the external intelligence arm of Britain. You can rest assured that Richard Moore is a very well-qualified professional. And William Burns is what we used to call a dedicated public servant. He spent many years in the State Department. My guess is performing intelligence functions with diplomatic cover. His father was a very distinguished, I think, Army general. He's devoted his whole career, as did his dad and his family, to government service. Really quite impressive, especially nowadays when we tend to denigrate people who are committed to our government.
You also wrote recently about Japan's elevated presence in the Pacific in terms of being a defense partner for us and for South Korea. Could you just talk about a couple of the most striking ways in which this has been evident? What are they doing that they were not doing before? How are they doing it differently than they did before?
Well, they have a steadily expanding military. I think they're still constitutionally limited to 1% of their gross domestic product devoted to military affairs. But Japan today, 1% is just a tremendous amount of money. They've rebuilt a large naval presence, especially naval capacity, especially during the Afghanistan, long Afghanistan occupation, which was the UN and NATO, not just the U.S. It's important to underscore, especially because I brought up Vietnam. They have been in the Indian Ocean on patrol, in support of that mission, or were. And they've been providing humanitarian relief to conflicts in the Middle East. It's the first time since 1945 the Japanese Navy has been in the Indian Ocean that far away from home. Japan, like Germany, is now accepted as a member of the community of nations and a reliable democracy. There are now trilateral military exercises involving the U.S. military, not just the navies, South Korea and Japan. Giant progress, given the history of acrimony and hostility between South Korea and Japan, between Korea and Japan, between Seoul and Tokyo. Big change. We've got a whole series of regional alliances that, to the credit of the Biden administration, they have continued to build and that have been being structured through this century as the perception that China is a rival, a potential threat, has expanded. There's something called the Quad, which is Japan, the U.S., India, and Australia, which seems like a stretch, but it's one of a series of initiatives, geographic stretch, series of initiatives that involve cooperation in the Pacific, a way of trying to kind of create a counterpart to NATO vis-a-vis China.
For that part of the world.
Exactly, which is much more difficult geographically and historically.
Sure. Very good. Well, let's finish out with the column that you wrote just ahead of the what's looking like now to be the one and only debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. So the column that you wrote was not a response to what ensued on that night in September, but as kind of a precursor to it, where you looked back to something that I know you enjoy talking about and you think is important for all of us as Americans to remember, and that is the dramatic televised debates between then Vice President Richard Nixon and his Democratic challenger, John F. Kennedy. Tell us what was so momentous about that and why you think it is worth remembering and appreciating all these years later.
Well, it's a very impressive performance by both politicians. I showed the first of 4-hour-long debates. I showed the first one to each of my classes this semester. I think it's important to do that in a presidential election year because it shows how much things have changed. And it's a basis for comparison. And I encourage my students in each class, not just for Americans, but people living in this country, and for that matter, anybody else. It's really important to understand the context of these very important, now regular debates. Thanks to Kennedy's initiative and his father's forceful appreciation of the power of the media, to put it politely, and Nixon's very gracious acceptance. Eisenhower told Nixon, don't do it. You may lose the election if you're given that free publicity. It really was significant, and both politicians should be thanked. Both of them are very good, and students generally see that. This year, that rascal Jack Kennedy is irresistible, even posthumously. A plurality in each of my classes thought he won. But of those who had an opinion, probably most of them did not have strong opinions. But they're two serious men who act like grown-up men. They don't blow kisses at each other. They don't hug each other. They don't insult each other, because if you did that in 1960, you wouldn't have won, and you wouldn't have been considered a man. It was a very different time. And they talked at length about policy. Nixon does look irritable from time to time because that was Nixon. But also they were supposed to be talking about domestic policy. And JFK shamelessly kept turning the debate to foreign policy and the number of scientists and engineers and teachers that the Soviet Union is turning out, and steel production and iron production, and they're in space first. And they really are going to bury us if we don't get moving again, get this country moving again as it was under Truman and FDR. It was extremely effective. Nixon kept politely trying to move the debate back to foreign affairs, but without success. And the shamelessly pro-Kennedy panelists, the moderator was more neutral, but none of these guys called Kennedy on, in effect, changing the rules. And, of course, this was 1960. It was the usual suspects, all a bunch of white guys, more or less, on stage. And we certainly had less real diversity and less inclusiveness. Sorry, they become cliches. But foreign policy and fear of communism was dominant. And I use that as an opening to talk about the fear of China today. Soviet Union's gone completely. Japan replaced the Soviet Union for a time in the later stages of the Cold War and really did seem to be taking us over economically. That was a scary time until suddenly in the early 90s they in effect, collapsed economically. So a basic question, which does engage the students, is how come we're still around for all our problems?
Yeah, interesting.
I think I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to ask you, what was the point of Mr. Kennedy steering the debate in the direction that he did? I mean, did he think he was steering it into an area in which Nixon would be more vulnerable? And if so, why would that have been a more difficult terrain for – or was he just trying to catch him off guard and find him maybe ill-prepared? I mean, any idea why Kennedy would adopt that tactic?
Yeah, I think you're being too cerebral, Professor. You're thinking too much. No, that's what people were really worried about, foreign policy.
So just the fact that Kennedy was talking about what was on people's minds.
Of course, that's what politicians do.
Okay.
Also, as Eisenhower pointed out to Nixon, and as Kennedy's and his father and brother realized, Nixon's going around saying, I'm the senior statesman who's been there with President Eisenhower. This teenager in a sports car, you know, he's about 17 years old running. Nixon wasn't that specific, but that was the thing. And by appearing equally on TV and Kennedy not falling flat, he acquitted himself quite well, actually.
Right.
I was particularly impressed this time around, maybe because I saw it more than once and shorter. They're both extremely quick-witted, and Kennedy holds his own very well and brings up facts that put Nixon off balance. They're both very, very sharp. But this whole strategy of Nixon, it was destroyed just by appearing as equals. I think Nixon was trying to do the right thing. He was trying to engage in fair play. He was also trying to overcome his image as the hatchet man, which was an albatross around his neck from the beginning of his career in the Joe McCarthy era, when he was very much a right-hand man to Senator McCarthy for a while. So he was kind of put into a corner by appearing to be not such a bastard. Mm. He gave Kennedy an opening to appear more aggressive. Mm. I hope that's clear.
Yeah, no, very much
because,
so.
Because, you know, people were really worried about foreign policy.
Sure.
I was a kid then. We had drop drills in school. Mm. We'd all get under our desks or go out in the hallway and sit in a kind of vertical ball with our arms over our heads.
I remember that myself, absolutely.
Well,
yeah.
This was in Los Angeles, California, prime target area.
Right.
Even us little kids thought,
sure.
You know, this is not going to...
Right. But let me tell you, in elementary school in Decorah, Iowa, we were engaging in similar things. I mean, I only remember that from first grade, I think. Eventually, maybe that fear receded. But I see what you mean. So it made Kennedy appear more on the wavelength of the average American in terms of what they were feeling and fearing in that moment.
Yes, but it was still, of course, a very close election, and the whole thing was a seesaw. The only time these debates have ever made a decisive difference was in 1980, the one time that Reagan and Carter appeared directly. Reagan, as a good guy, a regular guy, he got lots of extra coverage by appearing with John Anderson, the renegade Republican congressman running for president. Carter refused to condescend to meet with him. But after the Reagan-Carter debate, Reagan, who has been behind, shot up in the polls. Mm. People think that's what happened with Kennedy and Nixon, but it didn't. The whole thing was a tough struggle, back and forth, back and forth.
Well, and I think you've maybe even mentioned on this program that for those who listened to the debate rather than watching it on television, the polls indicated that people had thought Nixon had won.
No.
I mean, on words alone, whereas the visuals gave the advantage to the younger candidate, John F. Kennedy.
That's what everybody says, including a couple of my students. Interestingly enough, on behalf of Senator Kennedy, let me make the point that there was more than one TV for every household in America in 1960. These television sets were everywhere.
Wow.
And the older demographic, the rural demographic, on balance, a more Republican demographic, tended to still be listening to the radio.
Interesting.
On the other hand, on behalf of the vice president, if you actually sit down and read the transcript, which I've done more than once, Nixon is much more logical. It's a much tighter lawyer's argument.
Hmm.
Kennedy is much less focused, much more playing to the galleries. So if you're a judge looking at two attorneys, and Nixon was the one with the law degree. No, Nixon had it on points. Nixon had it on points, you know, the camera loved Kennedy, and poor old Nixon was tired. He was sick. He was wearing the wrong kind of suit, and he looked like a grouch.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the camera would pan to Nixon every time he looked.
Yeah, right. Shaking his head and looking unhappy. Yeah, yeah. Well, on that note, I'm afraid our time is up, but it's been an interesting hour, touching on a whole lot of different matters, of course. And as always, I've really enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you, Dr. Artsir. We appreciate each and every time you grace us with your presence on the morning show, and look forward to having you back in October.